people have always said that in England and Wales in the middle of the 15th century, there'd been years and years of wars of the roses between the noble houses of Lancaster and York. But that wasn't invented until later. Henry VII, king after 1485, seems to have started the story, but it didn't get its name, Wars of the Roses, until 1829, and then it came from the romantic novelist Walter Scott.
But something significant had taken place in England and Wales in the 15th century. Ever since at least the Norman Conquest in 1066, English monarchs had been kicked out and not infrequently murdered. But between 1460 and 1485, the violence reached a crescendo. And then, just as strikingly, it came to an end. Since 1485, only three English monarchs have lost their throne. So what had happened?
It's good to see you at the History Cafe. Thanks for joining us. This is where we come to give a new take on history. We revisit well-known stories that have got stuck in our collective memory, but just don't look right anymore. I'm Penelope Middlebow.
And I'm John Rosebank, and I suppose we have the best job in the world.
I think we do.
We take the latest research and we ask the questions that nobody else seems to, and we put it all into stories everyone can enjoy. So find yourself a coffee, pull up a chair, and let's see where we end up. By 1450, it had been for years obvious that King Henry VI was not capable of governing England and Wales. Modern medical historians suggest that he probably had some kind of mental illness. He may, for example, have been bipolar. Well, it needn't have been a catastrophe. It was normal practice for a council of nobles to govern, for example, while a king was too young to reign. Indeed, such a council had met since Henry had inherited the throne back in 1422 as a baby, and had then gone on meeting even after he'd reached 18, which was the age when an English king would normally have started to govern for himself. But in 1445, when Henry was 23, he was married to Margaret of Anjou, and his French queen had resisted all attempts to keep power in the hands of a council. She appears to have wanted to run the kingdom herself.
Now, I need to come in here, because feminist accounts of Margaret of Anjou have tried to claim that she was opposed simply because she was a woman. But it wasn't that. If the monarch couldn't rule on his own behalf, then a council of the great nobles was the proper way to go. Not a French queen who promptly surrounded herself with her own little knot of advisers. And above all, not if she was so jealous of England's greatest landowner and the acknowledged most experienced administrator that she kept him out of the council and even tried to deprive him of his lands. And he, you'll have guessed, was Richard, Duke of York. Many people even agreed that if Henry died childless, York had the very best claim to be his successor.
Well, that was until 1453. And then, after 8 years of marriage, Queen Margaret of Anjou finally had a son. Well, royal couples, then as now, were expected to get on with producing an heir as soon as possible. It would make sure that there would be a proper succession. What was at that time perceived as Henry and Margaret's long failure in this department, as in so many others, had added significantly to everyone's doubts about the king's suitability to reign. And you have to say that the birth in 1453 of Prince Edward immediately raised plenty of eyebrows. It came just as Anjou's campaign to keep the Duke of York out of power was becoming both serious and bitter. The arrival of a royal heir at this moment looked, well, remarkably convenient for Queen Margaret of Anjou.
Unsurprisingly, there have ever since been rumours about whether the boy was in fact Henry VI's son. Now, historians who've discussed it have been distracted by the idea that, well, perhaps Queen Margaret went off and, in a bid to keep the Duke of York out, got herself pregnant by one of her favourite nobles. But such an affair would, of course, have been exceedingly difficult to conceal, and had it emerged, it would have been completely disastrous for the Queen and for Henry VI, and would have destroyed the baby's claim to be the royal heir. And in that situation, York would have been unstoppable. Anyway, there's no evidence that such an affair ever happened.
But I suppose there's always the possibility possibility that Henry allowed himself to be persuaded by his wife in this, as in almost everything else, well, that if he couldn't get her pregnant, then maybe he should quietly allow someone else to do it for him. That would be the very best way to put the Duke of York in his place.
In that case, the obvious candidate to do the deed would not have been some noble, but one of the king's trusted servants. He could have got the job done in the king's chambers in complete secrecy, and his discretion would have been absolutely guaranteed. Nobody would have believed him if he'd claimed to have had sex with the queen.
And, well, what do we discover? That as soon as the queen gave birth to a son, Henry roused himself from his torpor and gave an extravagant annuity of £40 a year, which is a huge amount of money in 1453, to one of his closest personal servants, one Richard Tunstall.
Mm-hmm.
Tunstall had until recently just been Henry's meat carver. He'd then been made an esquire of the body, and soon afterwards he would be knighted. Later, he would be among the handful of loyal servants who escaped from England with Margaret of Anjou and would then stay with Henry VI even after he'd been kicked off the throne. Well, you can only say that it would not be at all surprising if Richard Tunstall turned out to have been the boy's real father. But of course, we shall never know.
Prince Edward's birth, anyway, seems to have galvanised his French mother's determination to run the kingdom herself. So what was already a crisis in government now escalated until, at the end of 1459, serious violence broke out.
Yeah, as in armies in the field. We'll get to all the details of that later.
What matters here is that Richard, Duke of York, was killed. But soon after, Anjou and her son were driven into exile, and York's son, confusingly also called Edward, was made king.
Now, the point here is that whatever we've all been told about the Wars of the Roses between the Lancastrians and the Yorkists, the violence that broke out in 1459 was not fundamentally a family feud about who had the best claim to the throne. It was a quarrel about who could best sort out the mess that Henry VI and his French Queen Margaret were making of governing the country. This was a quarrel mainly between Richard of York and Margaret of Anjou, not between Yorkists and Lancastrians.
Of course, the new king, Richard of York's son Edward, pointed to his own royal lineage as he called for the support of his new subjects. But interestingly, when Parliament agreed to make him king, nobody even mentioned York's family tree. Instead, the parliamentarians agreed that Henry VI, quote, had offended against the realm. And that was why Edward of York had been chosen by the people to replace him. In fact, they used the word elected. One visiting diplomat from Milan reported, quote, how the people of London, the leaders of the people of the island, together with some other lords, full of indignation, had created a new king. He was chosen, so they say, on all sides as the new king by the princes and people of London.
Yeah, elected, which of course means chosen in the 15th century. Elected, chosen, created. This wasn't about finding a legitimate king because of his family tree. It was about finding a capable one. And you have to say that Edward of York was 6'4", what's that, nearly 2 metres, 19 years old and a decisive, charismatic, good time boy. He was very much a man in the mould of his grandson, Henry VIII. He was certainly and self-evidently a very great deal more suited to being King of England than the unpredictable recluse Henry VI or his embittered French wife, not to mention her son, who was still barely 8 years old.
So what had happened had not been a family feud in which people had had to pick sides between Lancaster and York. And neither was what followed a long series of wars between the two families. What caused all the violence that followed was the painful breakup of the House of York. Whatever was going on from the 1450s in England and Wales, it was not fundamentally a dynastic struggle between Yorkists and Lancastrians, wars between white roses and red roses. It was a crisis created by Henry VI's mental illness and his French queen's ill-advised determination to rule England and Wales in his place. The upshot was that Henry VI was deposed, thrown in prison in the Tower. Queen Margaret and her son were driven into exile, and Edward of York, who was widely agreed to be next in line to the throne, was chosen elected as king.
And nor was what followed an extended series of wars between Lancastrians and Yorkists. What happened over the next 25 years was the long and very violent breakup of the House of York. The best place to read the story is in historian Thomas Penn's recent and very readable The Brothers York. In 1470, Henry VI, Lancastrian, was briefly restored to the throne for a few months. But that was only because disgruntled Yorkists, led by Edward's very own brother, the Duke of Clarence, along with the Earl of Warwick, had invaded with French help and put him there. One disgruntled clique of Yorkists around the Duke of Clarence had got rid of another clique of Yorkists around King Edward. Putting the feeble old Henry VI back on the throne in Edward's place was just a sideshow. He was now a puppet of the Yorkists.
Within months, Henry VI was anyway turned out again. And this time, he was got rid of. He was murdered by Edward of York, who put himself firmly back on the throne. Within a few years, Edward had also killed his brother, Clarence, and the Earl of Warwick.
Well, the Yorkist dynasty would finally come to an end in 1485, when Edward IV's brother, Richard III, was defeated at Bosworth by an invading army under the nominally Lancastrian Henry Tudor. But you see, this was no more a Lancastrian restoration than the brief return of Henry VI had been.
No, Henry Tudor's army was largely made up of Breton, Welsh and Scots with 4,000 Frenchmen. The French calculated correctly that Henry Tudor had no real claim at all to the throne of England. So they tried to persuade him to pose as the Lancastrian Henry VI's long-dead son. It was only now that Tudor therefore dusted off an old little used Lancastrian emblem which his mother had sometimes used, the Red Rose.
Well, two die-hard old Lancastrian campaigners did join Henry Tudor, one Jasper Tudor and John de Vere, the Earl of Oxford. But the point is that most of the men who joined Tudor in France had in fact been Yorkists. And we now know that the invasion was in fact the product of a deal negotiated between the Lancastrian Henry Tudor's mother, Margaret of Beaufort, who incidentally had twice been married to prominent Yorkists, and the Yorkist Edward IV's widow, Elizabeth Woodville, who'd in fact been previously married to a Lancastrian. You following? The point here is that there never really had been two sides, Lancastrians and Yorkists, Red Rose and White Rose. The two sides were hopelessly entwined and muddled up with each other. The idea of two competing dynasties is a complete nonsense.
Henry Tudor was chosen not because he was Lancastrian, but because he happened to be the man best placed to do the job of getting rid of the dangerously unpopular King Richard III, who'd had the boy, King Edward V, and his brother killed in the Tower.
No, he really did. No, don't believe anyone who tries to tell you that they escaped.
Tudor was safely in France, which meant he could raise an army there. But before he did, he had to agree to marry the daughter of the late Yorkist King Edward IV and his Queen Elizabeth Woodville. So, if the invasion succeeded, Tudor's heirs would be neither Lancastrian nor Yorkist, or perhaps they would be both, if you like, and there would be an end to any talk of a family feud.
Well, Tudor's invasion did, of course, succeed, and at the Battle of Bosworth, he became Henry VII. He did, as promised, marry Elizabeth of York. He then, as we've seen in our previous discussion, produced the so-called Tudor Rose, a combination of red and white, and crowed about the way he'd ended the long old feud between the Red Rose Lancastrians and the White Rose Yorkists. This, then, is the origin of the story. It was an attempt by Henry VII to bolster his own distinctly feeble claim to the throne.
But whatever Henry VII wanted to claim, England hadn't been divided between two rival camps. Remember Henry's own mother and her alliance with Edward IV's widow? Both women had married across the Roses Divide, and both were quite happy to get together and sort things out between themselves.
And the point is that we know that they were typical of their time. In a really remarkable piece of research, historian Matthew Ward has studied monuments in churches from this time. You know, the carvings of local gentry and all their armour that lie on top of their tombs. Well, he found that 15th century families often had their dead publicly depicted wearing Lancastrian or Yorkist symbols. Well, that's no surprise because such favours were highly prized. They'd once been given to their wearers by whoever happened to be on the throne at the time.
But when historian Matthew Ward hunted through local records, he discovered that during the lifetime of these people, nobody had apparently cared whether you were Lancastrian or Yorkist. even at the height of the violence, and in the country's most hotly contested Midland region, families who had themselves carved in church with Lancastrian or Yorkist badges had gone on happily marrying each other and doing business together across the Roses Divide without any signs of hard feelings. So, except apparently when it came to the details of the formal dress in which you were depicted on your tomb and perhaps had worn on ceremonial occasions, England had not been divided into Red Rose Lancastrians and White Rose Yorkists.
So the roots of the extraordinary outbreaks of violence in the years from 1460 to 1485 did not lie in some family feud. But nor did they just lie in the personal weakness of monarchs like Henry VI or Edward IV or Richard III. They in fact go much deeper than this. Now eventually we'll go looking for them among the ordinary farmers and craftsmen of England and Wales. But the first thing we discover as soon as we begin to look for deeper causes of the violence is that there had been a profound and important change within the English and Welsh nobility.
What we've been seeing is that the extraordinary outbreak of violence in the later 15th century in England and Wales was not, whatever later generations imagined, a war of the roses between Lancastrian and Yorkist dynasties. Its roots lay much deeper. One explanation has long been that the violence was caused by what historians termed overmighty subjects. It was, the argument goes, stirred up by wealthy nobles who had more money than sense and ideas above their station.
Well, this is an idea that dates back to the period itself. England's top judge, Sir John Fortescue, whom we've in fact met before, warned in his book, The Governance of England, written around 1470, of, quote, the perils that may fall to a king by overmighty subjects. I wish you could see the 15th century spelling here. These overmighty subjects, Fortescue explains, were nobles with more money than the king, who, quote, aspired to the estate of a prince and found it feasible to rebel, since, quote, the people will go with him that best may sustain and reward them. There was, concluded Fortescue, quote, no greater peril for a prince than to have a subject equilopolente to himself. Well, equilopolente was basically another word for equal. It seems that Fortescue was apparently thinking here about wealth.
Whatever happened to equilopolente?
Yeah, they don't make words like that anymore.
I love it. I'm going to use it in future. As historian Michael Hicks has pointed out, the idea that the Wars of the Roses were really a spat between noble knights who'd got out of royal control was an interpretation that particularly appealed to the Victorians. Well, maybe it was because, led along by the romantic fiction of writers like Walter Scott, the Victorians loved to imagine the good old bad old days of chivalry and knights in armour. I mean, in August 1839, 100,000 spectators went along to the reenactment of a medieval tournament, you know, jousting and sword fighting. It was held at Eglinton in Scotland.
Yeah, and sadly it was completely washed out by rain, but there we go. It's a very interesting subject, the Victorian revival of chivalry. The best book on it is by Mark Giroir. The notion that the Wars of the Roses had been a kind of embittered, generations-long joust between two noble families, or perhaps some bloody free-for-all among armoured knights defending their honour, went on in various forms, being the accepted explanation for the Wars of the Roses until 1964. In that year, the historian Kenneth MacFarlane, widely regarded these days as the father of 15th century studies, in that year, he gave a lecture at the British Academy that simply rubbished the whole notion. Overmighty subjects, he declared, were not the cause of 15th century violence. Quote, only undermighty kings had anything to fear from overmighty subjects. If the king were undermighty, his personal lack of fitness was the cause.
Now, what we've already seen shows that MacFarlane had a point. England and Wales did indeed suffer an unfortunate series of weak monarchs in the 14th and 15th centuries. Their subjects agreed that they were inutilis, useless, as they put it, or that they were, in the case of Henry VI, sadly actually out of their mind. Edward V, one of the princes in the Tower, was just a young lad when the last thing you needed was a young lad on the throne, and Richard III, who murdered him, made a catastrophic series of blunders that cost him the support even of his own family.
But there is a problem with this explanation. Perhaps it's a product of the way academic historians tend to closet themselves away in one period and ignore the rest. As we've seen, there'd been plenty of weak kings and queens before the 15th century, without provoking an extended period of bloodshed like that in the so-called Wars of the Roses, though you have to say the civil wars of the 12th century came pretty close. What's more striking is that there were plenty of weak monarchs after the 15th century.
Edward VI was just 9 in 1547 when he succeeded his dad, Henry VIII. Just 2 years later, in 1549, there were some of the worst rebellions of this entire period, but none remotely threatened the king himself, who died of a chest infection aged 15 in 1553.
Edward was succeeded by his two sisters, England's first two queens, Mary and Elizabeth. Well, they both also faced significant rebellions, and in Elizabeth's case, an imminent danger of invasion from Spain. But neither was ever seriously threatened. Okay, 1554, the rebels reached the gates of London, but Mary braved it out, and they were soon scattered. Both of England's first two queens died in their beds. So, Kenneth MacFarlane's argument that the violence of the 15th century was caused by undermighty monarchs only gets us some of the way to solving the problem. Useless royals are a feature of every period in English and Welsh history, but mostly they survive, and especially in the centuries after 1500. Undermighty monarchs are not the problem.
Well, MacFarlane also argued that there had been much mightier subjects than the supposedly overmighty subjects of the 15th century. And he took the example of John of Gaunt, who in the late 14th century had been much wealthier than anyone during the Wars of the Roses. But he hadn't provoked any similar time of troubles.
Well, this part of MacFarlane's argument started a long debate among historians about whether the nobles in the 15th century really were either mightier or less mighty, or more precisely richer or poorer than their fathers and grandfathers. Well, of course, the answer is that you can always find examples of both to choose from. But this argument from the nobles' account books, in themselves a notoriously unreliable source of information, also misses the important point. The nobility of the 15th century may or may not have been wealthier than before. The point is that as a group, they were significantly different from anything that had been seen before. And it's this that turns out to make the 15th century unlike any other. It's really the first persuasive key to understanding the so-called Wars of the Roses.
The episode of violence, traditionally inaccurately known as the Wars of the Roses, cannot be explained as a dynastic feud, and nor simply as a consequence of a sequence of poor monarchs. Nor is it clearly linked to any new and obviously overmighty or overwealthy group within the nobility. But the nobility of the 15th century was very different from what it had been 100 years before.
The historian Gerald Harris has pointed out that the number of peers, which are basically landowners with aristocratic titles like Earl and Duke and so on, fell by half between 1350 and 1450.
Wow.
From 147 to 73. Well, that's an extraordinary statistic. And before 1350, peers had apparently been even more numerous.
Well, the obvious reason for the sharp decline in the numbers of nobles was the Black Death. The bubonic plague arrived in Britain in 1348 and spread extremely quickly. So quickly that within a year it had killed 2/3 of the population. Plague pandemics then returned every 10 or 20 years or so until 1665, although it was never quite as bad as that first time. Now, wealthier families were less affected than others, but they didn't escape completely. It meant that between about 1350 and 1450, fewer landed families than normal were able to pass on their lands in the usual way from father to son, or even, as often then happened, to several sons. Far more estates than usual were therefore being broken up.
Or they ended up being passed from father to daughter, shock, horror, or to some other female relation. And that in turn meant more wealthy heiresses. And since wealthy heiresses, as historian Simon Paling has pointed out, tended to marry the male heirs of other landed estates, the result was a smaller and smaller pool of landed families all marrying amongst themselves.
individual landed families might become richer or poorer than before, that tended to depend on how many children they had and how much land they were able to accumulate by marrying wealthy heiresses. But that's not really the point. What we're talking about here is that there were far fewer aristocratic families than before.
And at the same time, there was another connected change. From about 1375, the peerage, in other words, the titles of men like dukes and earls and barons and so on, for the first time became hereditary.
First time.
Automatically passed on from one generation to the next. They hadn't been before. And for the same demographic reasons that landed estates were becoming concentrated in fewer and fewer and fewer families, the so-called peerage was also therefore becoming smaller and smaller. It was being transformed into a tight, interrelated little group.
What made it even worse was that when a king made a man an earl or a duke, he was expected to give him landed wealth to go with his new title. But as we've briefly mentioned, English kings in this period were getting poorer and poorer. So there was very little incentive for a king to create more than the minimum number of new nobles, especially if they'd then be lumbered with them because of the hereditary title for generations to come. It was a further reason that until 1450 at least, the number of nobles went on getting smaller and smaller.
Now, all this mattered because English kings had always depended on the landowners, and especially the nobility, to run the country. 15th century kings had no regular army, no police force, no civil service. When the people of Kent launched a significant rebellion in 1450, for example, it was up to the local bigwigs to keep them in order. If the king decided to go to war against Scotland, as Edward IV did in 1463, or against France, as he did in 1475, he would have to get his nobles to recruit soldiers. And in the furthest corners of the kingdom, most exposed to foreign invasion and furthest from royal influence, the king had little choice but to allow the great landed families to rule almost as local monarchs. So it was the Percys and the Nevilles who ran the north, the Stanleys were in charge in Cheshire, the Courtenays and the Bonvilles lorded over the West Country. More Nevilles, Lord Burgaveny and others, ran the show in Kent. And there were other powerful families in Wales.
Now, put all this together. No, the 15th century did not see the appearance of a new brand of super rich over mighty subjects. But it did apparently witness the emergence of a new breed of landowners and nobility. One of the things that was different from before is that there were now far fewer noble families, and they were far more interrelated than before. Some of them, far from London, were exceedingly powerful in their local areas.
Well, one result of all this seems to be that they were also more inclined to get into feuds with each other. Or perhaps it was that these feuds just mattered much more than they had before. Percy's got into armed fights with Nevilles in the North Country. Courtenays and Bonvilles fought it out in the West Country. In 1451, Thomas Courtenay, Earl of Devon, raised an army of 5,000 or 6,000 men, huge in that time, and besieged the castle at Taunton. In 1456, Walter Devereux and Sir William Herbert attacked Carmarthen Castle with a force of 2,000 men. Meanwhile, Kent was becoming a battleground, fought over by Lords Burgaveny and Brooke and Cobham and the Neville family.
Historian Gordon McElvey has examined the cases of local disturbances that were discussed in Parliament. He came across them in 1414, 1421, 1427, 1432, and so on and on through the century. From the 1380s, Parliament had been repeatedly petitioning successive kings to sort out the problem of widespread lawlessness and violence. And McElvey found that much of the trouble being discussed in Parliament had actually begun with quarrels among local landed families.
Now, within local English and Welsh societies, towns and parishes, in fact, the great landowners were beginning to lose their power, as we shall see later when we take a more local perspective on these quarrels. But what we've already seen raises the possibility that the fundamental cause of the violence in the 15th century was not some feud between two great families. It was the failure of successive English monarchs to keep order within an entire unruly cadre of interrelated and quarrelsome landed families. Fewer in number, puffed up with their new hereditary titles, riven by family jealousies, perhaps aware that they were beginning to lose their authority in towns and parishes. It seems that the nobility may have become more surly and difficult to control in this period than they had been before.
Well, there had always been a tried and tested way for a monarch to keep troublemaking landowners quiet. You whisked them abroad, you took them off to war, and you made them part of your select group, your band of brothers in arms. Enter Henry V, in the words that Shakespeare would later put into his mouth before the Battle of Agincourt.
From this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. And be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here.
As we shall see next time at the History Cafe.
There are nearly 100 podcasts at the History Cafe, all of them still as new as the day they were recorded. Go to our website, historycafe.org, and you can get a rundown on the research we've done and plenty of leads to follow if you still want more.
You'll find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every other platform you can think of. Just look out for History Cafe Podcast with John and Penelope. If it's your thing, follow us on Instagram and what used to be Twitter at History Cafe Pod. And ask your friends to join us too.